From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Yesterday was Super Tuesday, so we'll start with a look at how Georgia voted. Plus, a new study found black teachers and white teachers view their students very differently. We'll revisit a conversation about racism in the classroom. Then we'll wash it all down with a trip to Waffle House. We'll speak with a former president about Southern cuisine and the restaurant's record label. Oh boy, that's coming up this hour. First, though, we spoke with Congressman John Lewis yesterday about turnout, voter ID laws, and what's going on in U.S. politics. He told us the advice he gives to his colleagues.
I tell my colleagues from time to time of both sides of the aisle, pace yourself and respect others and never become bitter, never hate. The greatest need is to bring people together because we're all in this thing together. We're all in the American house. And we must look out for each other.
Here are your first thoughts.
Hi, my name is Dennis Loth. I'm calling from Farmington, Georgia. About this morning's program, Congressman Lewis is a great man, and many of the things he said are idealistic and wonderful. But the truth is that the American public is sick and tired because we don't get to take any decisions in this country today. It's been predisposed, pre-designed on what's going to happen. The rich control everything. We don't have control of this country. It was sold a long time ago.
Ted Terry tweets, Congress won't govern because 90% of districts are gerrymandered. Fix that and you fix fearful Congress members. A lot of cynicism on the part of Georgia voters, sounds like. And we want to hear what you think. What did you think about last night's election results? Call us at 404-500-9457. Leave a message like Dennis did. Or you can tweet us at OST Talk or post on Facebook. We might feature your comments on the show. As you mentioned, voters went to the polls yesterday to make their presidential picks. Here now to recap the results is Richard Wolff. He's a reporter with The Guardian U.S. Richard, it's a pleasure to have you.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
What were the questions we needed to answer yesterday, especially about voters in the South?
Well, we wanted to see, first of all, on the Democratic side, if Bernie Sanders could do anything to make any inroads into especially the minority voters who dominate the Democratic votes in the South. I'm afraid for Sanders supporters, the answer was resoundingly clear. He couldn't, and Hillary Clinton won some very, very lopsided victories, including in Georgia, of course, winning there by more than 40 points and taking the lion's share of the delegates. On the Republican side, you know, there was the question about where, if anywhere, could the non-Trump candidates win. We saw that in Texas, in Oklahoma, but the South, in this divided race, in this split field, is still very much in Donald Trump's hands.
So one of the questions I know some people had was whether or not the black vote would stay with Hillary Clinton. And in Georgia, at least, the bulk of the Democratic Party is made up of African Americans. So did we get that definitive answer yesterday from Georgia and the rest of the southern states?
We absolutely did. The race was called right as the polls closed. For a good reason, because the voting was lopsided, heavily favoring Hillary Clinton, actually not just in minorities and African Americans, but across the board. You don't win 71% to 28% by just taking black voters in Georgia. There's no question that Hillary Clinton had a very, very strong night. And just in terms of the delegate count, because we can talk about what it means for voters across the country, but in terms of the delegate count, Hillary Clinton took more of a delegate lead out of Georgia alone than Bernie Sanders took out of the four states that he won last night.
So, Richard, what about turnout? In the primaries we've seen so far, we've seen record numbers of Republicans voting in some of these primaries, and we certainly saw that in early voting in Georgia. We set a record last night for early voting, and over half of those were GOP voters. So are we learning something about turnout that could happen in the general election, or is this sort of lopsided number of voters going to the polls only a primary thing?
Well, there's no question that there is energy and turnout on the Republican side. Just taking a look at the Georgia numbers, about 1.2 million votes cast on the Republican side, 750,000 on the Democratic side. There are good reasons, of course, why Republicans might feel more energized, not just because they want to change everything to do with the Obama administration. It's a contested race, a strongly contested race. You might say that Georgia Democrats are, they knew what the result would be. They were not as energized because it's not as much of a fight. Still, there are warning signs there among Democrats about turnout, and there's no question that the Clinton campaign is looking to see if they can drive turnout by really building up the threat, the prospect in their minds of a Trump presidency. So that's what they're banking on, that Donald Trump will drive turnout in the fall, not just for himself, but for the opposing team as well.
Well, let's take a listen to Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz needed to win his home state of Texas. He did. And here he is saying he's the best candidate to take on Trump.
And after tonight, we have seen that our campaign is the only campaign that has beaten, that can beat, and that will beat Donald Trump.
Richard, what did we learn about who might be the best candidate? I know that there's many in the GOP that are now calling on people like Ben Carson and John Kasich to drop out. But did we get evidence about whether Marco Rubio or Ted Cruz are most likely to fight Donald Trump more strongly?
Well, look, the fact that both of those guys, Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio, won states last night. And by the way, Rubio's win in Minnesota destroys the Ted Cruz talking point that he's the only one who has beaten Ted Cruz. But the fact that they both won means actually great news for Donald Trump. He continues to split the field, and in this split field, he is winning. When you ask who is the best candidate, well, Donald Trump is the front runner. He's the front runner among Republican voters. He's a strong performer in the notional, the hypothetical head-to-heads against the Democratic candidates. So, you know, when you look at who's best, you have to ask best for whom. And Republican voters have really tipped their hand here. They are saying they want Donald Trump. He has got a very strong delegate lead, and there's no path short of a complete collapse for Donald Trump. There is no path for Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio to win enough delegates to take the nomination.
What you just said is that right now, reasonably speaking, Donald Trump will be the GOP nominee.
Absolutely. You know, once we get to March 15th, the rules change for the Republican contest. You move from proportional allocation of delegates to a winner-takes-all system. The RNC wanted to end this primary contest quickly. They do not want a protracted battle. They changed those rules. If this continues for another couple of weeks, Donald Trump will be the nominee before the month is out.
And can we say on the Democrat side, similarly, that unless something serious happens, that Hillary Clinton will be the Democrats' nominee?
Well, the proportional allocation continues through the Democratic race. They haven't changed the rules midway. What that means, though, is that Hillary Clinton now has a pledged delegate, that's not including the party insiders who are the superdelegates, a pledged delegate lead of about a couple of hundred delegates. You know, once Barack Obama in 2008 got to a lead of 100 delegates,
yeah.
Hillary Clinton could not overcome that lead.
That's Richard Wolff. He's a reporter with The Guardian U.S. Richard, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And now on to a different kind of competition, baseball. A Macon teenager's love for the sport led him to some forgotten history of the Negro League. The Eagle Scout discovered Negro League players from his hometown and then secured their place in history. GPB's Leah Fleming reports.
My name's Gordon Smith. I'm 15 and I go to Mount DeSales Academy.
Gordon, a baby-faced shortstop, is one of the few African-American players on the JV team. He and the other players take in some serious batting practice on the spring-like afternoon. His love of baseball and a recent family vacation to Missouri led him on a journey to finding his roots.
We went to Kansas City, and we went to the Negro League Museum there, and I had an idea. Well, I had a thought. If any Negro League players were from Macon. So when I came home, we did our research, and I found that there were four, and I wanted to honor them.
So we set out to find these men. With the help of the museum in Kansas City, Gordon identified Lemuel Hawkins and Marion Kane, who are now deceased. He also found Robert Scott and Ernest Big Dog Fan. That nickname has stuck with Fan since he was 6 years old, after a kid in the neighborhood decided Ernest just wouldn't do.
He said, "We're not going to call you Ernest." So that sounds like a girl's name. He said, "You are bigger than we are, so we're going to call you Big Dog."
fan now lives in Alabama. But after talking to Gordon, he traveled home to Macon and joined Scott, who lives in the city, for a ceremony honoring the four Maconites who played in the Negro Leagues. As part of an Eagle Scout project, Gordon raised money for the four plaques that now hang on the walls at Macon's Luther Williams Field. No team currently plays at the park, but it is the second oldest minor league stadium in the country and is full of history. Williams Field was the setting for the major motion picture 42, a biopic about Jackie Robinson, a former Negro League player who broke Major League Baseball's color barrier. Like Robinson, Big Dog played Negro League baseball before transitioning to the major leagues. He's now in his 70s, wearing a burgundy jacket with a Negro League patch on it and a baseball hat. And he still looks like he could throw a fastball fast.
Right now, it hit me that what I did was important. And that's one of the greatest feelings you can have, to know that you went through life and was an impact on a country. That's a good feeling. And I feel great right now.
There are lots of layers to the story of black baseball.
Ray Doswell is a curator of the Kansas City Negro Leagues Museum in Missouri. He helped Gordon find Big Dog and the others. Doswell says a lot of history is top down. Think your high school history class. But much of history comes from the bottom up. The Negro Leagues is a part of that bottom up history.
There's a lot of interest in the history. It's obviously a lot of interest in baseball still, in sport, and that's a motivation for a lot of communities to try to dig up and mine their archives and people for information about, well, do we have great baseball greats here? Do we have a connection to this great broader story? And the young man tapped into that, and he's provided a great example for other communities to do the same.
Gordon says he'd like to play professional baseball one day, and after he retires, he'd like to be a marine biologist. And Gordon says finding the four Negro League players from his hometown gives him the drive to follow his own dreams. For GPB News, I'm Leah Fleming in Macon.
We also want to take a moment to remember a member of Atlanta's Negro League team, James Red Moore. He died last month at the age of 99. He was believed to be the last surviving member of the Atlanta Black Crackers. Here he is speaking during a panel at Georgia Perimeter College.
We played for the love of the game, you understand that? Instead, we didn't make any money, but we were what you call the trailblazers or the catalysts, pioneers for all these our black ball players.
For more on the Negro League, visit gpb.org. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. When it comes to education, all students deserve a fair chance. But research out of the University of California, Santa Barbara found black and white teachers tend to view their students very differently. The study's author says recruiting more African-American teachers could help bridge black-white gaps in school discipline. Others, though, say that's only part of the solution. Enter Matthew Patterson. He teaches English at Banneker High School in Fulton County, and he's made it his mission to talk about race with his students. I spoke with him and Georgia State University professor Brian Williams back in December. Williams teaches early childhood education. And I began the conversation by asking Matthew a pretty straightforward question. Matthew, you are white.
Yes.
And you are in a predominantly black classroom.
Absolutely.
Now, your school is a Title I school?
Yes, it's a full Title I school, full free and reduced lunch.
Okay, so you have a large number of students of color.
Yes, I've actually only taught three Caucasians in my 10 years here.
Holy cow. And can you, going back 10 years, take me back a decade ago when you first entered that classroom. Did you have any idea that there might be an issue being a white teacher there?
Well, you know, I've seen the movies. Right?
Right.
So that's part of all of our cultural conversation. But I can tell you about my first period. So I planned a lesson that was based on, I thought, something culturally relevant. We're going to discuss one of the Roots, my favorite band, their lyrics. Right? So we're going to get into small groups. Well, I came in there full of, you know, private schooling and some of the best education money can buy. And I went in there, and in my first, you know, 2 minutes, I was I was in for a shock. My first moment there, I had a student. So number one, I tried to get everybody in small groups, and it didn't work. And so after that, I went up to an individual student who I later learned to love. But, you know, he said, if you don't get the blank out of my face, I'm going to blank and blank and blank him, right? So that was my introduction to teaching. And I, quite frankly, I wasn't, there's nothing that could have prepared me for that level of animosity.
So, Brian, this brings me to you because you're one of those people that tries to prepare people, right?
Yeah, that's the work I do.
So
yeah.
The movie, I mean, Matthew mentioned movies, but the typical scenario is a white teacher goes into an urban school district and saves the day, right?
Yeah.
Inspires all
the Messiah.
These, right.
Yeah.
Inspires all these kids. And it may be for many people a real rude awakening when they find out that's not going to happen.
Absolutely.
How do you prepare somebody for what Matthew went through?
Well, I think Matthew kind of is baptism by fire for him, right?
Yeah.
He got into
right.
a classroom and he began to understand, wow, maybe I don't know as much as I thought I did about these children and where they come from. So I think the work that we try to do is to get people to be to at least interrogate their own ideas, their own beliefs, their values, the things that they're bringing into the teaching profession with them. Because I think that for white people in particular in this country, there's not a need for them to constantly think about race and its implications in their lives because they kind of live in a world where they are the norm. And so what ends up happening is you walk into a space where that's not true for other people with that assumption that everybody else lives this way as well. And it creates disconnects and it creates issues in the classroom. So one of the things that we try really, really hard to do is before you even enter into the classroom is to get you to begin thinking about, well, what do I believe? Why do I believe it? Where did those beliefs come from? So that you don't carry things into the classroom with you that might harm children.
Matthew, do you find that you think about race more often now than you did before you started teaching at the school?
Oh, I mean, it's an absolute different perspective. I agree with everything that gentleman just said, 100%, right? I wish I had said it. I feel like, you know, it's for me going into a classroom, I have learned just as much as my students. And I know that sounds like a cliche, but it really is the truth. To me, whenever you put a Caucasian in a room full of African Americans, it's almost like notes on a musical scale that most people have never heard before, right? And for me, part of my own understanding and coming to understand my own place as a teacher is knowing that, you know, I was not nearly as down as I thought I was 10 years ago. I just hadn't been a part of the conversation.
Brian, one of the issues we have in this nation in our public school system is that students of color are more likely to be suspended, they're more likely to be disciplined, they're more likely to be expelled for the exact same offense that, say, a white student would be just spoken to about or would not be disciplined for. What do you attribute that? Is it partly this sort of gap in racial understanding?
Yeah. I think that it speaks to expectations, right? So I think that, for instance, when I work with teachers, oftentimes when they're going into what you say, an urban school, you know,
yeah.
right? So, and it's interesting when you say urban child, urban school, immediately we have ideas that pop into our head about who these children are, what their parents are, what their communities are like. And so in terms of new teachers, they always want to know, well, how do I discipline? How do I manage the class? How do I keep these kids under control? Because for many people, going into that community, going into that school, it's about control. It's about discipline. They need more discipline in their lives. And so in terms of the school-to-prison pipeline, we kind of this idea of this harsh discipline policies, kicking kids out of the classroom.
Zero tolerance.
Zero
yeah.
tolerance. It kind of speaks to our expectations because for some children, you know, if they're misbehaving in the classroom, if they're not paying attention, we'll look at that child and based on our expectations, we'll say, well, you know what, maybe they're bored. Maybe they need more enrichment,
right.
And they get more work, right? A poor child, a black child who does the same thing, a Latino child that does the exact same thing because of our expectations of who they are as people. It's, well, they're misbehaving because they're disrespectful. Their parents don't talk to them about the way to behave at school, and so they get dismissed or kicked out of the school or out of the classroom. So a lot of it is based in our beliefs, our values about who these children are, who their parents are, and the communities that they come from.
Matthew, how does that jibe with your experience in the classroom? Do you see teachers coming in and feeling like they need to take control of or establish control?
Yes, I mean I can only speak for myself, but I do think that many people want to impose their own thoughts on the classroom, And those don't necessarily work, but instead of learning from their students, they continue to enforce their will. I mean, to me, good teaching is about relationships.
Absolutely.
It's about a commitment to student success, and it's about thoughtful reflection and purpose done by the teacher. And if you're a teacher and you're not going home every night asking, how can I do this better? How can I speak to my students? How can I make culturally relevant material come alive for them? Then you're not doing your job.
So how did you get through this, Matthew? I mean, you told us about your first day in school, which was not so great. But now, as I understand it, you're pretty well respected among the kids. How did you get from there to here?
Yeah, you know, honestly, I've never been shown love like I have been by the Banneker student community. To me, they've named me the star teacher 3 years in a row. But for me, it's about apologizing when I make mistakes, right? It's about really trying to find out and have honest, authentic conversations. And I think the one way that I have been successful is that I'm not afraid to tackle the difficult topics. So, you know, we'll talk about Laquan McDonald, right? We'll talk
Laquan
about...
Laquan McDonald is the teenager who was shot to death by police in Chicago. Yeah. Keep going.
We'll talk about the N-word, right? And I have to tell you, about 8 weeks into my teaching career, I decided that I wanted to talk about it, right?
The N-word?
Yes. I wanted to hear their stories, right? And I was shocked. I had no idea. And I know that sounds very naive and, you know, and it is, I'm sure, but I guess I wasn't aware of the issues that a lot of my students faced. You know, I just wasn't aware of it. So for me, it's about learning as much as I am teaching.
So I wanted to put this comment to you, Brian. One of our listeners just tweeted, so the young teacher's story about being threatened by a student on the first day was just a lack of cultural understanding?
Hmm. I mean, let's talk about humanity, just human beings. I think if a teacher is threatened by a student, I think that's humanity. That things like that happen. And so I think that's kind of an apples and oranges conversation. I think we muddy the waters when we begin to talk about that, because I think what ends up happening is we then can't talk about the real issue, which is that you do have teachers that are coming in the classroom who are unprepared or ill-prepared to actually, what Matt's talking about, be culturally responsive, create instruction that actually is relevant to your children, that values their experiences. We do hear about teachers that are hurt by their students, that are attacked by their students, but I think that's a different conversation. And once again, I think we muddy the waters when we try to conflate and put those two things together.
Could I respond to that as well? Well, so I think oftentimes the students that are most likely to say those types of things are the most in need of individual attention and the most actually wanting. Those are the ones who are broken, right? And to me, I think it's really important, because I want to make sure that I say this correctly. Like, that particular student turned out to be one of my absolute favorites in 10 years. We had a great relationship. It was just a rocky beginning, right? And I think that's the main thing, is that not all relationships start well. I can tell you that, right? You know? And so it's really, really important that teachers stay the course, you know? Don't act, because it's a relationship just like any other, right? If you're in the classroom with a person for an hour and a half, you really get a chance to know your students, right? And just like you, I wouldn't want to be judged on a first date for the rest of my life.
Right.
You know, I think it's really important that we don't judge students on one comment, you know?
We have about a minute left here, Brian, and I wonder what you make of what Matthew is saying in terms of what helped him get through. He mentioned honesty and authenticity a lot, which I assume means he admitted when he didn't know something about another culture. Yeah. How important is that?
I think it's extremely important. And in fact, I think that's probably one of the best things that we can do as teachers, is to begin to try to understand our students. I think that we claim that we understand each other as a nation, that I know what these people are like, but oftentimes it's because somebody else has informed our perspectives. It's either the media, the movies, a book, right? And I think that if we can figure out ways to authentically and you know, really understand who our teachers, who our students are, who their parents are, what their communities are, what languages they speak, what they value, what they believe, that will allow us to better teach them and connect with them.
That is Georgia State University professor Brian Williams. And we also spoke with Matthew Patterson, who teaches at Banneker High School. Matthew and Brian, thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
One thing that I am sure gets teachers in Georgia, like Matthew, through the day is coffee. If you are a coffee drinker in Atlanta, your options abound. There's almost a dozen gourmet coffee shops that have opened in the city over the past year. We took a tour of some of them and bring you this audio postcard.
So look around and you will see coffee shops popping up all over Atlanta. I think you can safely say that 2015 is the year that craft coffee exploded. My name is Brad Kaplan. I'm a food and drinks writer for Creative Loafing and for ThirstySouth.com. So when I think craft coffee in Atlanta, the first place that comes to mind is Octane. And Octane has several shops around town right now. The Octane West Side is the one that's kind of my personal home base that I go to most frequently. And part of the draw is their great espresso, their great coffee. But I think also part of the draw is the fact that they embrace the creative community. There's always different art on the walls if you go in from one month to the next. They host events that are geared around creating dialogue in the creative community in Atlanta. So they're not just a place you go to get a cup of coffee, but it's a place you can go and appreciate the folks around you and what's going on around town. And frankly, seeing coffee as a hub for creation and production and moving forward. So it's, again, not just about the coffee. It's about all the things that go along with that. A lot of the new coffee shops, they realize that it's as much about the people as it is about the coffee. Chattahoochee does a particularly good job than your typical chain store would in terms of welcoming you in, making sure you feel at home.
Hey, so what are the beans you have on espresso right now?
So Hologram is a blend. It is kind of like the chocolatey, but also has some fruit-forward characteristics.
My name is Nathan Nerswick, and I work at Chattahoochee Westside. I've been working here since we opened, coming up on 10 months.
So it's going to be extremely fruit-forward, and Berhanu Zerahun is actually the name of the farmer, so that's a limited release.
Oh, wow.
I love that I get the opportunity to introduce people to a whole nother side to coffee that they don't expect. Everyone has an experience with coffee, whether good or bad. Everyone has coffee. And so to get to be a liaison to people and someone like you come in and say, well, I want something strong. I want something bold. Okay, cool. What does that mean? You know, not ostracize them, not fill in a stereotype of the snooty barista, but instead welcome them into what is such a cool industry. It truly is a craft.
The cool thing about these coffee shops is they're constantly bringing in coffee beans from different parts of the world, from different farmers, and these shops let you experience those and see, okay, I really gravitate towards one style of coffee versus another. So there's tons going on in Atlanta right now, and I think it's very exciting, and I think the small, local, independent, unique people are the ones that are really bringing that excitement.
That story was produced by On Second Thoughts' Kenny Moore. Do you have a favorite coffee shop in Georgia? You can tweet it to us at OST Talk. And if you're there now, show us what's in your cup. You know, nothing goes with coffee quite like waffles and hash browns.
At the Waffle House on Christmas, my true love gave to me a bowl of delicious hot grits. At the Waffle House on Christmas, my true love gave to me
two waffles baking
and a bowl of delicious hot grits.
Whether you like your hash browns scattered, smothered, or chunked, Waffle House has you covered. The restaurant chain has served diners 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, for more than 60 years. And as GPB's Sam Whitehead finds out, it's not just waffles they're serving.
Waffle House restaurants are noisy when they're busy. Waiters call orders over burbling conversation. Frying food spits and sizzles. Dishes rattle in the sink. Sometimes a jukebox joins that chorus, playing music you won't hear on the radio. This song is called There Are Raisins in My Toast, It's one of about 40 songs that Waffle House has released since the mid-80s on its own record label, called Waffle Records, of course.
So it's not Waffle House, Waffle House, Waffle House over and over again in the song. It's about our food. It's about our people. It's about the things that happen. If you just sit in a Waffle House and listen to the conversations around you, we try to represent all of that at some degree in the songs.
Shelby White is the senior marketing manager with Waffle House. She's also the head of Waffle Records, which she runs with a small team. She says the songs aren't supposed to be commercials, more like mood music.
You know, you could tell a difference when you walk into a restaurant and it's just, say, empty, or there's no sound other than, you know, maybe what's going on the grill, versus when you add music to the background, it lifts it up and it gives a different feeling and atmosphere to the experience.
Even when the songs aren't explicitly about food, they manage to work Waffle House into their lyrics, and they come in any number of styles. There's gospel.
Thought I'd grab a little bit of breakfast when I saw the yellow sign.
Bluegrass.
The very best T-bones and strip will melt right in your mouth. And steak and hungry people get together at the Waffle House.
Boy band R&B. And good old American rock and roll.
This is Saturday Night at My Place, one of my favorites.
That's Jerry Buckner. He produced this song and many of the other Waffle Records tracks. Sitting in a Waffle House in suburban Atlanta, Buckner says the idea to produce the songs came from Waffle House co-founder Joe Rogers Sr., who had high standards for the work.
If it sounded too much like a commercial, it got the axe.
Once a song made the cut, Buckner says it would be recorded and pressed on vinyl 45s. Those 45s would then be put in Waffle House jukeboxes. Today, the process is digital and much easier, and Buckner says he's talking with Waffle House about producing more songs.
And I think we're going to kick back in and start doing a lot more of them.
But is there any demand for new Waffle House songs? I spent a few hours in a Waffle House one recent Saturday morning, and nobody played any of the Waffle Records songs. Then I decided to broaden my search.
So I'm here at the Waffle House, one of the Waffle Houses here in Atlanta. None of the top 100 plays on this jukebox are the Waffle House songs.
I finally found a chart topper at my fifth restaurant. There are Raisins in My Toast set stranded in the 60s. So the songs aren't all that popular. By Waffle House's count, they only got 1% of all plays last year. But Shelby White, head of Waffle Records, says she's happy with that figure.
We're not trying to get played on the radio. If anyone wants to play it, that's great. But it's all about inside the restaurant. So every time it plays one time, that's just one more time that we're extending the experience.
I asked White how much Waffle House spends and makes on Waffle Records, but she declined to answer. She told me the return on investment is hard to pin down. Even so, Waffle Records is still up and running. Their most recent song is called Color Me Gone. It's not likely to be a hit. But, like all the other Waffle Records songs, the very curiosity of its existence makes it worth a listen. For GPB News, I'm Sam Whitehead in Atlanta.
The Waffle House ain't far away.
And it came as a surprise to the On Second Thought team that producer Sean Powers has now lived in the South for almost 2 years but never stepped foot inside a Waffle House. He says he'd rather eat at local restaurants, even if they're more expensive.
I'll eat at places that look fascinating, that, you know, look a little bit more upscale. Like, I'm willing to spend $20 on a meal. I don't want to spend $5 on pancakes. It just doesn't really appeal to me.
Obviously, this had to be addressed. So we took Sean for his first meal at Waffle House. And here's what happened.
Hi, good morning.
Welcome, everybody.
How are you?
Good. I'm Ellen. I'll be your server today.
Hello.
Everybody doing okay?
What do you suggest?
You got to get the All-Star.
What's the All-Star?
You get a waffle, 2 eggs, grits, or hash browns, bacon, sausage, or ham. You get one choice of the meat. If you're going to do hash browns, then you got to do the famous smothered and covered. That's onions and cheese.
Why isn't $6.85? Like, why isn't it more expensive?
Because they give you a discount. It's a deal.
I wonder if I can take some grease to go.
I can get you a whole bunch of grease.
She knows what I want.
And what are you going to have to drink?
A hot chocolate made with soy milk.
No soy milk.
What do you think this
is? We're not that healthy.
All right, can you just do water?
Sure. scrambled hoagie yolk. I got a little gravy on your plate there.
First impression, Mr. Powers?
For some reason, I thought this came at the waffles. Does it not?
It does. The waffles coming. We're going to run out of room real quick here.
So there's more food?
It's coming, yeah.
We have gravy, we have hash browns, we have eggs sunny side up, because that's the only that's the true American way to eat eggs. We got some jam, we got some waffles. Would it be weird to put some of these things on top of the waffle? Like make it a little.
You can do anything you want.
Really? Give it a shot. What were all your first experiences like at Waffle House? What brought you there in the first place?
A love of waffles.
Were you drunk? Were you with church, family, people? What?
I was down south, and I believe I was with a good friend who actually was from Florida. He was all like, "Let's get Waffle House," and I was like, "That's a thing? A house just made where they just make waffles?" And he was like, "Yeah." I was like, "Well, I'm there. Let's do it."
I don't remember my first Waffle House experience. It's just such a part of my life.
Cool.
Sean's dying.
No, I put too much hot sauce on the hash browns. Oh man. Why don't they call themselves like Hash Brown House? Like the waffles don't look that special.
Waffles are good.
You haven't even tried the waffle yet.
I feel like they should re-identify themselves as by what they're known for. And my feeling is that's probably the Hash Browns.
I'd say it's equal. My best friend and I would always pick a Waffle House to meet at in between like holiday break, because she went to college in D.C. and I went to college in Virginia. So we meet at Waffle House and hang out before we had to go back.
This is some comfort food.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God, I think we need a nap after this.
And we heard from some of you about your favorite Waffle House experiences. Linda Mitchell from Athens shares this story about a trip she took with her children 40 years ago.
I was driving with my three children across I-10. And we stopped at a Waffle House, and one daughter had headgear and retainer and all that kind of stuff. During lunch, she had to take it out and put it on a napkin. We finish lunch, we get back in the car and head down the road, and notice she's crying in the back seat, and she had forgotten her retainer. We turn around, about an hour back, walk in, and a waitress is smiling and has the retainer and the headgear. And she said when she was cleaning up, she noticed something in the napkin. And when she looked inside, she saw that it was this expensive dental appliance, and she kept it. And so due to that wonderful server in Waffle House, we had a marvelous trip. So thank you, Waffle House.
Thank you so much for that sweet story, Linda. And we love to hear about your favorite memories, whether they be at Waffle House or elsewhere. You can tweet us at OST Talk or call and leave a message like Linda did at 404-500-9457. Bert Thornton joins me now. He's the former president and COO of Waffle House. Yes, he's the Bert behind Bert's Chili. And he's also the author of a new book called Find an Old Gorilla, Pathways Through the Jungle of Business and Life. Bert, it's a pleasure.
Well, good morning, Celeste. It's great to be with you.
So how did Bert's Chili come about? Is that your recipe, or did you just love it?
Well, you know, that's my creation, but it wasn't my idea. I was living in Dallas, Texas, and the chairman, Joe Rogers Jr., came out and said, you know, we have great products, but we're serving a canned chili, and that doesn't make any sense. You're in the chili capital of the world here in Texas. Will you come up with a good recipe? And so I did. We put it in, and it was an overnight home run. And the next thing I knew, he had put my name on the menu next to the chili. He said it was for a job well done. I think he just wanted somebody to supervise the quality of the chili for the rest of his life, because if your name is on it, you will taste it everywhere you go.
So one of the things that you really emphasize in your book, and it's part of the parable that gave the book its name, is finding the right mentor. And I wonder, how often do people, especially in business, choose the wrong mentor? Is that a common thing?
Yes, I think it is. Great mentors have a certain set of traits that are unique. The best mentor for a person is someone who has a real interest in you, obviously a good listener. But critical is they have to have a solid track record of success. Otherwise, why would you listen to them? They have to have knowledge in your specific area of interest. And here's the most important point. They have to have peer respect. The greater the respect for your mentor by his or her peers, the greater your chances of success. That seems to be the litmus test. And just because somebody is friendly with you doesn't mean they would be a good mentor. Some businesses even assign mentors, and that's kind of the luck of the draw. Sometimes they're good, sometimes they're not.
So you went from playing football into Waffle House, so you've basically run the gamut of really, really Southern things. What mentor did you find? Who was your mentor?
I really had three. My first one was my dad, who passed along so many, many, many good social traits. One of them was honesty and the ability to get along with a lot of people in any kind of endeavor. But then beyond that, I guess my second mentor was Joe Rogers Jr. Joe and I were fraternity brothers at Georgia Tech. And he got into the business and then called me and said, why don't you come in too? And I did. And we worked together for over 40 years. And in those 40 years, he had a lot of great ideas that he shared with me and a lot of great ideas about how I should do things that he was never shy about sharing with me. And I listened and we succeeded.
Some of that, though, and this is, again, something that you write about, is learning how to take criticism and know the difference between constructive criticism and not. How do you do that?
Well, that's a great question. I think the first thing that you have to do is take the barriers down and be open to criticism. Understand that it's not a perfect life you're leading. And then listen to people that you respect. I kind of tune out the idiots, but for people whom I respect, when they come to me with information about things that I'm doing wrong or should be doing differently, I tune right in and listen because they're saying it for a reason.
So let's get back to Waffle House, a business that you've been with for a very, very long time. I mean, what is Waffle House's core competency? I mean, it's not just waffles. I would say I would go to Waffle House for the hash browns, but what do you see as the real strengths of a Waffle House?
Well, it's the food, sort of. We serve soup, salads. We got the best chicken in the world if you've never had it. Steaks, chili. But the main thing is the Waffle House experience. When you walk into a Waffle House, it's not like any other restaurant you've ever been in. I was listening to your staff member who'd never been in a Waffle House, which I find unbelievable.
Shocking, right?
Yes. Amazing. He did not have the Anthony Bourdain experience in Charleston, where Bourdain was gaga about Waffle House.
Right.
But it's the experience. When you walk in, it's sort of overwhelming, I think, the first time, particularly if it's very, very busy. And it's different in different states. If you walk into a Waffle House in Indiana, there's more of a family atmosphere. If you walk into a Waffle House in Texas for lunch, it's mostly businessmen and women. So it's different in different states, but the experience is always one of friendliness between customers and staff, and just a real pleasurable experience while you're having and enjoying great food.
We only have about a minute left, but does the menu change from state to state?
No, it's the same menu, and as a matter of fact, the menu doesn't change from year to year. In the 40 years I was with Waffle House, we took two things off the menu and added three. So the menu doesn't change from state to state.
Wait, what did you take off the menu?
Well, the pineapple and cheese salad.
People don't go to a Waffle House for salad. Shocks me.
Well, it was kind of an afterthought. But the menu doesn't change because we're all about sameness. Our customers move around a lot, so we want them to have the same menu opportunity in Texas as they do in Fort Lauderdale.
As Bert Thornton, he's the former president and COO of Waffle House. His new book is called Find an Old Gorilla. It's now available. Bert, thank you.
Thank you so much.
That is our show for today, but tell me, what is the best breakfast and the best breakfast for a weekend morning, not a work day when you might be rushing through it, but the perfect breakfast on a day when you can actually relax and enjoy it? For me, I guess it would be a hash browns, a bowl of fresh fruit, some strong coffee, and two eggs over medium with wheat toast. That's me. What about you? Perfect breakfast. Call us at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OSD Talk or post to Facebook.com/On Second Thought Radio. For today, that is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.